This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run, 8:46 right now. I'm Melissa Idris with Julian Ng and Sharad Kutan. We're taking a look at the business headlines of the day. RSPO, the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil, is in the news again over the IOI Corp case. Now, an NGO called Aid Environment Asia, they have threatened to leave the RSPO over its handling of the IOI case. Now, if just some background to this, IOI was one of the founding members of the RSPO, but it was suspended in April, then reinstituted, I believe, later the year, August. But now we've got an NGO who is unhappy and threatening to quit RSPO, which they say should be promoting certified sustainable palm oil.
I think we've come to a point where the views of the various stakeholders matter. I mean, before this, it was just about whether you want to buy a product or not. If you don't want to buy, then go elsewhere, right? But right now, people think about other things like the environment and so on. I remember being in university and I wrote an essay about how we might come to a time where people will vote with their money not based on the attractiveness of the product, but based on whether that product fulfills environmental concerns and things like that, right? And my lecturer put there, this is a little bit too utopic, right? But now I can say that, hey, look at what's happening here. People are voting with the other kinds of interests that they have, especially the environmental interests.
Right. I mean, I think they've been the whole question of free trade products and eco-friendly products that have been in the discourse for a long time. But coming back to the story of palm oil that's had its ups and downs. I mean, recently we had the palm oil industry had good news, right, over the pushback on the Nutella tax in France, where that proposed...
That's nothing. It's a small... I guess that news was about the potential to flare up all over Europe, but...
Yeah, I mean, it was good news for palm oil producers because an attempt to tax the use of palm oil was pushed back. I mean, and that extra levy would have hurt palm oil producers in this part of the world. It doesn't solve the problem that, Julian, you rightly put out, which is, again, we need to save the environment. We need to keep, these industries sustainable even as we consume these things.
But, the other argument is that the West, countries like America and Canada and the other parts of Europe and so on, have already cleared all their forests, right? And now is it a case of the pot calling the kettle black that we are just at the cusp of development, that we are ruining the environment? Mm-hmm. How fair is that argument?
Yeah, well, the argument, in fact, is, I think, out there already that, because of the historic legacy, that while our problems are common, there's a differentiated responsibility. So it's common but differentiated responsibility. The West, having already destroyed so much of the planet, needs to put in their extra share for precisely that history.
If I could just come back to the issue with RSPO at the moment. Now, according to the Edge Financial Daily, they spoke to an analyst who was covering the sector and said that this is all, not really the best of times for the RSPO, and they may even need to take an unpopular decision. If the RSPO sways towards the NGOs, they risk losing the planters. So this is a balancing act that the RSPO needs to play, trying to make sure that the NGOs are happy and satisfied with what they're doing. But at the same time, you don't lose the planters that you've certified, right?
I think if the planters walk out of the RSPO, to me that is Armageddon in the palm oil world, right? Right. Because RSPO is also supported by the consumers and they are very powerful. The likes of Nestle and Unilever have to be accountable to their consumers and the stakeholders as well, who today believe in the fact that our world needs to take care of global warming, climate change, and so on. So I think it's not so easy for them to press that button that launches the nuclear bomb, right? They can't. It's hard for them to walk away from that.
Mutually assured destruction.
Yeah.
Okay, some interesting comments coming up from the Malaysian Capitalism in Comparative Perspective event yesterday. So the former second finance minister, Tan Sri Dr. Noor Mohamad Yaacob, who's also the chairman of Khazanah Research Institute, KRI. Now, he said that Malaysia's model of capitalism is quite unique in this world, and despite being unorthodox, it has worked to the country's growth and poverty eradication efforts. So he cited examples of the NEP and the subsequent policies, success stories in this, in eradicating poverty. And he says that Malaysia's model of capitalism should be carried on.
I'm not sure whether the NEP has worked because we have not explored any other alternative. For example, if your economy is very successful based on some kind of a merit-based policy, you could have actually a much larger tax collection because of this unfettered innovation, right? And this large tax collection could be then redistributed to those right areas. And this is so relevant now, especially the fact that we have a kind of de facto digital policy that we want innovation. We're talking to people like Jack Ma and Mark Zuckerberg, and MDEC is going to the Silicon Valley to have this relationship going on with them. What about our local policies? Can that be changed in such a way that would bring innovation from within?
Well, I think the defenders of the NEP would point to two things. One is the NEP was never anti-growth. It was always premised on growth. It was just growing the pie and sharing it, right? So you have the redistributive policies, but you also have growth policies. And I think this government, for all its faults, can always claim that it was pro-business from the very start. The other thing I think is to recognize that NEP was not just a instrument of economic policy. It was a political compact. It was a political policy. It provided the stability on which economic growth could then carry on. So, yes, we could have had a laissez-faire system and we could have done better, but it also could have been very unstable because it didn't take into account, in some explicit sense, the need to make everybody, to include everybody. And I think that's what the NEP kind of explicitly does. It talks about inclusion. So I think the defenders of NEP will say that it was the pragmatic solution for the time. But you're right, Juliet. Hazard is exhausted. It's become a system of entitlements. Mm. It's become, perhaps the cause of the kind of moribund economy that we have. And people are rightly saying it's time to move on, though there's no indication the government is willing to give up that.
Well, speaking about the economy, Sharad, noted economist Professor Jomo Kwame Sundram was also at that capitalism comparative event yesterday. And he made some interesting comments too. He said that Malaysia actually needs to focus on real economic indicators rather than financial indicators. He said that the way the government is running the economy is dogmatic and it follows what the World Bank or, you know, financial media like the Wall Street Journal, Financial Times dictate. He says we should be looking at other things, real economic indicators.
Yeah, I'm not sure what these indicators are because I wish the article was a little bit more detailed about this. But, you know, we can think of a few like our educational standards, how happy we are, for example. And this really ties in also to the discussion about NEP because has the NEP achieved a certain level of national pride that is expressed in our happiness, our level of education, our civic consciousness, right? And I think on those counts, the NEP has just failed very sorely because we still see a lot of injustices that are around. So, and I think that he made allusions to a national interest policy as well. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure what these national interests are because I feel that the NEP policy has resulted in something of a confiscation or a nationalization of a lot of business in the name of redistribution, right? And which is why today we have the dominance of the GLCs and the GLICs and very little ownership by the private sector.
I think Jomo, as a scholar, you know, documented the crony dimension of capitalism in Malaysia. I think he, people like Terence Gomez, pointed to, you know, politically linked businesses and vice versa. And so I don't think they would be advocating more cronyism. I think what he means by national interest would maybe be in, say, a discussion we have over the sale of strategic assets to China and Chinese entities. Because the loss of your ability to control those, especially for public policy reasons, right, not just for economic and financial ones, are very important. So a nationalist policy isn't necessarily going to be in that way, you know, about just sort of supporting locals for the sake of it, right? I think it's a much more complex and sophisticated...
For the people, maybe. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and for national interest. Basically, how...
Especially what national interest, though?
Well, you see, in a globalized world, like, for instance, right, in a globalized world, you might want to have controls over your natural resources. Now, if you open up, say, mining to all and sundry, you might actually have find yourself in a situation where you cannot protect your environment. And this was, you know, the conundrum for the Philippines when it, you know, when there was pressure on the Philippines to open up its natural resources to all and sundry. And so, you know, I think we're looking at that. We're looking at questions of, you know, being able to price your medicines. And this is why the TPP was so controversial, right? The loss of sovereignty, not in that atavistic, nativist kind of way, but in that real sense of protecting and making sure you have public policy options that go beyond corporate interests.
I think this kind of protectionism can go a little bit too far as well, because I know that economists believe that one of the most fundamental tenets of growth, economic growth, is an industrial base and manufacturing activity, right? And in that fervor to establish that, you know, the government has come up with ideas like a Proton and, I don't know, Malaysian Airlines, and look where that has taken us. It has 1MDB, for example. I don't know whether there is any developmental elements in 1MDB, but it has really established for us conduits of temptation. So much leakages out of these GLCs and out of these so-called national interest companies, right? How much have we spent to bail out Malaysian Airlines and Proton?
Is it a question of principle or is it a question of management? If we had better management of these entities that you
sure,
just mentioned,
yeah.
could it have been a successful
perhaps,
policy?
Perhaps.
We look at Singapore, see, look at the number of GLCs.
Look at Korea,
well.
Right? Look at South Korea. They have managed to have fantastic industrial policy. Samsung exports to the world,
right.
Hyundai, Kia, what have you, export to the world. And perhaps they have done it well under national interest, but we have not, right?
So I guess it's a matter of execution, the government being very bad at managing businesses. We've got the opening numbers from Bursa Malaysia coming up after in the 9 o'clock news bulletin as Bursa's opening bell is just about to ring. Keith Kam will bring you the opening numbers, so stay tuned right here on The Morning Run, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.